Hi there. Welcome to Open Mic. I'm your host, Leanne Akers, and today we're talking with Dr. Wendy Fletcher, the local family nurse practitioner here in Moorhead, and Dr. Jessica Estes, a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. Thank you both for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now today we wanted to talk about a really serious subject that has been taboo for quite some time, and suicide prevention is a very important issue and a thing that a lot of people are very concerned with, but people are not really able to talk about it very, very often. And you both deal with this every day in your practices. So I guess first we really wanted to talk about how we recognize that there's an issue when you meet a patient, even if it's a teenager or someone that you might not be able to communicate it clearly. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, the first thing I would say is it's time that we all start recognizing that we need to have that conversation. What I would tell parents is it's okay to ask your children if they are contemplating suicide, if they have ever thought of hurting themselves or hurting anyone else. We see a lot of school violence right now, and we see a lot of kids coming into our offices who are very depressed, but it's almost as if they are afraid to talk about it or ashamed to talk about it. And what I would have parents to know is that those conversations are going to be happening. On a national level, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have now made asking and screening for depression a quality metric. So every healthcare provider seeing anyone over the age of 11 will now be asking your child or even you as the parent going into the office, have you, you know, ever thought about hurting yourself or someone else? Are you feeling down, depressed, or hopeless? And how often in the last 2 weeks have you felt that way? So it is starting to become more of a conversation point. And what I would tell parents is be encouraged by that. Someone is asking, and don't be afraid of what your child may say in answering. It's not a problem to ask your child if they're depressed. It doesn't plant any kind of seed or idea in their head. And, you know, teen suicide is very real, and we need to start addressing it as a public health problem.
I know that just recently in the news there was a young boy that committed suicide because of bullying. They were saying because of bullying, and we can't really know exactly what is in someone's head when they make these decisions to attempt to end their own life. Jessica, this is something that you specialize in. Mm-hmm. You work with people every day. Now, tell me some of the things maybe that you see that are like warning signs that maybe I as a parent can watch out for.
So one of the things that we think about as far as mental health goes is just the overall health of, you know, any child, any adolescent, any adult. And we really look at, do they have what we call healthy behaviors? Are they as active socially as they've always been? Do they report that they have general happiness? Do they feel like they have control, internal control over things in their world? And so one of the big red flags for children and adolescents is when they feel like the external world has determinants over what their happiness is. You know, we think a lot about, if you look at the KIPP survey from 2016, and that looks at high-risk behaviors in adolescents, substance abuse, cyberbullying, exposure to self-harm, cutting, burning themselves, pulling their hair out, as well as suicidal ideation and suicide attempts, Kentucky doesn't perform well. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, we're not good at being able to recognize what those symptoms look like, and we're not good at talking openly about the needs. And so when we look at kids, we want to know, are they doing those high-risk behaviors? Are we asking those questions? And sometimes parents don't ask, hey, have you ever used any drugs? Have you ever experimented with alcohol? Tell me about your social media platforms, and do you ever feel disappointed when you don't get enough likes on a picture? And teaching kids that their self-worth is not defined by the opinion of others, it's defined by their opinion of themselves, because what they feel internally is more important than what that external support should be. And so really looking at kids and how to manage those behaviors. You know, we always worry when they start isolating, when they're not doing the things that they used to do. They stop playing sports, they stop going out with their friends, they spend more time alone. We also worry when they have what we call darker behaviors. They gravitate towards music, books that are very down and dull, and then kind of stay in those gray areas of life. And so we want to make sure that we're really asking those questions at the right time.
I think a lot of times as a parent, you feel like I don't want to invade your privacy, and you don't know how to get past that barrier of teenagers being like, oh, mom, don't, you know, don't ask me that, or why are you being silly, and it's hard to not feel silly yourself asking, and a lot of people don't realize how important it is to take the time.
Absolutely. I tell parents every day, you know your child better than anyone else, and I can ask them that question, and they may answer me in my office, but when you get home, that may be an opportunity for a broader conversation. One of the things that we really pinpoint on in the office is if parents report there's been a noticeable change in their child's behavior. And sometimes just seeing the interaction between a parent and the child in the office will kind of tip me off that there's something more I need to delve into. Of course, you know, if they're changing their daily routines, if we're seeing that they are consumed by social media and isolating themselves to the point that they're not even having dinner with the family when that opportunity presents itself, those are things, you know, when you see a child pulling away from their peers, pulling away from their parents, that's one of the clues that we're looking for. Another one that I think that a lot of parents overlook that is so important is how much sleep is your child getting? Teenagers next to infants need the most, but we know from years of study they tend to get the least amount of sleep, and we all know how we feel when we're tired. It impairs your reactions, it impairs your judgment, and when you're talking about teenagers who already have issues with that whole prefrontal cortex working in their brain, they don't always make the best decisions already, so you add fatigue to that mix, and it really heightens their emotions. And so I always tell parents, when you have a teenager who has this huge heart in this little tiny chest, you know, that sometimes they have to really wear their emotions on their sleeves, and we need to teach them how to cope with that. And one of the ways to do that is to assure they're getting enough rest to be able to process what they're feeling.
Now, when we talked a little bit beforehand, you talked about some other ways that you can help, not only with children who are showing symptoms of depression, but I guess preventative almost. What are some ways that you can help as a parent in each child's lifetime?
So we talk a lot about setting good boundaries and good structure. Children learn from us how to set limits and how to set boundaries and how to make sure that we're establishing good relationships, and then they pass that forward into their daily lives. And so when we set good examples of who's a good influence in our life, who's a bad influence in our life, how much time we spend on social media, how much time we spend with the family, we're modeling the behavior for those children and those adolescents. So that's one of those best ways. But the single most effective way to manage suicide prevention is to have good relationships. You know, we talk about in mental health, we call it a therapeutic use of self, and it's where I use myself and my relationship with that individual to help keep them safe. And it's the same way between a parent and a child. The single most effective way is to establish those good, solid relationships where the adolescent understands what those boundaries are and what those expectations are, and also understands what a good relationship is and how it goes both ways, and being able to communicate and have a conversation. Closed doors are never good for adolescents. The door's always got to be open, and they have to be able to walk through in a world where they feel like they're not going to be judged, because they're judged everywhere else. They need to be able to feel like that relationship with their parent is a solid one. But that doesn't mean that they don't have rules and guidelines and boundaries. As parents, it's our responsibility to limit that social media access, to set those hard boundaries for them, because they're unable to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, setting boundaries is one of the ways that we can take action. What are some other things that are that we're able to do as far as, you know, making sure that those boundaries are set in place?
Well, one of the ways is respecting those boundaries by parent and by child. And I tell parents every day, the most important thing you can do for your child is tell them every single day that you love them, that they are a huge part of your world, and that your world would be forever changed without them. Be thankful for them. Be, you know, show them graciousness whenever they do make mistakes or they do fail. You know, we're all imperfect. We're all human. As Jessica said, they're judged continually, and particularly in an academic setting, which just by its very nature is critique-filled. One of the things that I hear a lot in my office is kids who are maybe not performing well in a particular class in school, or maybe academically overall, and they tie their worth to that, because what they're hearing all day long with, you know, red-lettered scores on assignments is, this wasn't good enough. And what I encourage parents to do is assure your child, you're always enough. You're always good enough. And don't let a momentary situation force you into a decision or encourage you into a decision that would be, you know, forever life-changing, not only for them but for those around them. So I just tell parents, hug your kids, love them, tell them every single day they are enough, they are worth whatever it takes. And also use those opportunities where they feel like they've been critiqued or judged. Frame it, we say in the business, frame that into a reference that they can understand. Okay, you didn't do so well on this assignment. Maybe you failed this assignment, but that does not make them a failure. And so frame that into how could we have done this better, or what are our goals in the future, and how can we get to whatever that goal is. But don't ever make your kids feel like that their performance somehow, whether that's academically or athletically, or even socially sometimes, because not all kids are social butterflies, you know. Some are a little more quiet and reserved, and that's okay. But tell them every day you love them, they're enough. The other thing is find activities that those kids can be involved in so they don't feel so isolated. And even when that's just chores around the house, I tell parents starting at about the sixth grade physical, when kids come in for their, you know, sixth grade shots and physical exams, chores are such a good thing for kids because chores teaches them small moments of responsibility and helps you over time to build trust with that child. And I'm not talking about making their bed or picking up their dirty laundry. That only benefits them. I'm talking about feeding the family pets, washing the dishes or loading the dishwasher or setting the table, things that contribute to the family as a unit. Make those children from a very early age feel like they're a part of something bigger than themselves. I think it's really hard sometimes to get kids out of their selfies and out of their phones and out of their computers and their tablets. And, you know, it starts at such a young age now. I see two-year-olds with an iPad in their hand. It's mm-hmm. become the new babysitter. So I just encourage parents, be with your kids, be part of their life, be present, and have those conversations daily so that, you know, good and bad and everything in between, talk about it now, because when things get hard later, they're going to need someone they can confide and trust in, and that's going to need to be you.
And on that note, we're going to take a really quick break here on Open Mic. We'll be right back after this.
Come to the Moorhead Antique and Art Market, March 1st and 2nd at the Moorhead Conference Center, presented by Downtown Moorhead Incorporated and the Kentucky Folk Art Center. Shop for antique glassware, jewelry, furniture, juried art market, and on-site appraisals. Sneak peek on Friday, March 1st from 6 to 9 p.m. Open all day Saturday, March 2nd from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Admission is $3 for the weekend or $2 on Saturday. The Moorhead Antique and Art Market, March 1st and 2nd. At the Moorhead Conference Center.
And we're back here on Open Mic. I'm your host, Leanne Akers, and today we're talking with Dr. Wendy Fletcher, the local family nurse practitioner here in Moorhead, and Dr. Jessica Estes, a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. Thank you both for being on the show today.
Thanks.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about, if your child has these thoughts about suicide or just having depressive thoughts, they seem to be isolated, what are some of the things that if you think that you notice this in your child, what can you do as a parent? Because sometimes we feel a little helpless if we're not really well-versed in what it's like to be depressed. It's very hard to understand for someone who's never been depressed what depression looks like or feels like, and to be compassionate. So what should parents do if they start to recognize these symptoms in their teens?
So I always advocate to parents to start with your local primary care provider, whether that's your family nurse practitioner, whether that's your pediatrician, whether that's your pediatric nurse practitioner. Whoever knows that child best from a healthcare arena is the place to start, because they're going to be able to do the initial screen and really give weight to what your concerns are and make that judgment. That's where that primary screening happens. The majority of mental health issues are identified in primary care, so we know that. And so once you've done that, then that primary care provider can help you figure out what resources are best. Across Kentucky, we have a number of community mental health centers that are available to serve most of our rural counties, but you also have private organizations like my own that also have those services. So being able to figure out what is the local resource and which one best fits your needs. So perhaps you need somebody who stays late or works Saturdays, and looking for those community resources to be able to do those things. The challenge that I think Dr. Fletcher will attest to is in Kentucky, we are really struggling with adequate resources. There have been studies done over the last 10 years that recognize that we are absolutely in a mental health shortage, both in Kentucky and across the nation, but we don't have enough providers to meet our needs. If you look at the incidence of mental health disorders, it's somewhere between 4 and 10% of the country actually has a primary mental health problem. But we don't have anywhere near the numbers to serve those. And so being able to figure out what access to care is. And so access to care has to get better in order for us to do a really good job. You know, it's kind of like right now we're taking a piece of chewing gum and putting it on the crack on the dam and just barely getting the pieces by. We need to be able to fix the crack in order to really do what needs to happen and what's in the best interest of our children.
I had a conversation recently with someone about how mental health care, proper mental health care, is the root of all the issues that we are having in society right now. And I really think that, having access to the care is the most important thing that we can do, as well as helping to erase the stigma of there's something, you know, basically morally wrong with you if you need mental health care. That's not the case. It's just like having a broken arm. You have to go get care for a broken arm. You have to go get care for a mental health issue. Wendy, tell me a little bit about local access and some of the things that we need to see change.
So we do have a shortage of mental health providers here in the area, but we are fortunate enough to have St. Clair Outpatient Counseling. We also have Pathways, which is our community mental health center here. There are some private counselors available in not only in Moorhead in our local area, but in close proximity in some neighboring communities. So we still have access issues. There just aren't enough of them to serve the population, you know, that we have and the need that is there. So I tell parents, you know, because it may take you a couple of weeks sometimes to get in, what do we do in the meantime? And those steps are really simple. We keep talking about it. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that we don't talk about it. If your child fell down and broke their leg and was on crutches at school, every kid in school would be asking them, hey, what happened? And how are you? And can I sign your cast? We don't feel the same way about mental health issues, do we? We don't know that someone's depressed and go up to them and say, hey, how are you doing today? But that's exactly what we need to do. We need to be able to seek those people out, to recognize that they're having issues. We need to meet their physical needs and then be able to help them emotionally, spiritually, whatever. But at home, you know, I tell parents, keep talking about it. The other thing we need to do is make sure that while we're waiting on that mental health professional or that healthcare professional to see our child, is we need to keep our children safe. If our child has approached us saying that they're suicidal or they're thinking about hurting themselves or someone else, the first thing we need to do is ensure their safety. So we need to make sure that we're removing access to things like pills that they could use to harm themselves, or knives or blades that they may be cutting themselves with, remove alcohol that they may be trying to use in an overdose situation. Not only lock up the guns, but perhaps in that case, remove guns from their sight and from their access, lock up or store ammunition separately so that, you know, a lot of kids kill themselves very violently these days. They see it, you know, in their video games. They see it on social media. They see it in the movies that they watch, and they're not afraid to take those types of steps. So if your child has told you that they're suicidal or they're contemplating a plan, remove access to those issues until someone in the healthcare world can screen them and get them the help they need. And if you feel like they're an immediate threat to themselves or someone else, call 911 or take them to the ER. If you feel like it's something that you need some pointers on or you need to talk to someone and you need to do that immediately, we also have some 800 numbers with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1-800-950-6264, or the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-TALK. And that's 8255, 1-800-273-8255. Those are two resources that are available 24/7. Your child can talk to a counselor, a prevention counselor online, or through that phone number. There are text messages. They can chat back and forth with a trained counselor to try to bridge that gap between the time that you call for an appointment and you may actually get in. But, of course, there's always those immediate emergent resources available, too.
So the other thing that you can do is check with your insurance company to see if telehealth options are available. So, for example, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield has Anthem Health Live online that actually allows them to make an appointment with a counselor via video through a secure platform. So that might give you a little more immediate access than perhaps seeing that person face-to-face and might be able to bridge that gap. But your insurance company should be able to tell you where you can get that immediate access at as well.
Mm-hmm. And St. Clair does have telehealth services. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our kids will see a psychiatrist that's in Louisville or Lexington or Cincinnati, through the local telehealth service.
And really quickly, we've got a couple more minutes here on the show, but I wanted to talk about some legislation that you two are working on in Frankfort that we're hoping to get passed during this session. Tell me a little bit about what you guys are up to.
Thanks. So yesterday, our bill was filed, and it is Senate Bill 132. It's sponsored by Senator Paul Hornback, and it already has picked up bipartisan co-sponsors across the state. which we're very excited about. The issue that we're talking about today is really having improved access to health care, and we feel that nurse practitioners, which is the most rapidly growing section of healthcare professionals in the country, is one of those ways to improve access for all Kentucky citizens.
So what most people don't realize is that APRNs in Kentucky have always been independent practitioners, but we have to have what's called a collaborative agreement for prescriptive authority in the state so that we can prescribe. And one of the things in psych mental health is we do a lot of prescriptions, antidepressants, anxiolytics, things to get kids through. We treat ADHD, of course, as psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners, and really working on those things that put kids at risk. But without this CAPA, we can't practice. And so Senate Bill 132 allows us to phase out our CAPAs after 4 years of practice, which then encourages growth of the field. So right now, to find a psychiatrist that's not employed by a large organization that will sign our CAPA is almost like finding a needle in the haystack. Mm-hmm. And then it gets more difficult if you're going to specialize in any way, because that collaborator has to be of the same or a similar specialty. So I actually have to have three collaboratives. One, because my primary collaborator doesn't take any insurance. I have a second collaborator to keep my insurance credentialing, because the insurance company says as long as Kentucky requires a collaborative, then my collaborator must also take that insurance to keep my insurance certification. And then I have a third collaborator that allows me to be able to do my medication-assisted treatment. So I'm in Hancock County, and I'm the only MAT-waivered provider in my county. So without that MAT, my service population would have to drive counties away to be able to get that service. And so just to keep my baseline, I have three collaborators. And it's very difficult to secure those. I'm fortunate enough that over the years I've established solid relationships with my physician colleagues, but not everybody has that that relationship that I have and doesn't necessarily get to benefit from that. And so removing the CAPA allows us to let those APRNs practice to their full scope in education. We're not changing the number of prescribers, were already out there. It just means that we get to remove that piece of paper that inhibits their ability to get to the places they need to be, like me in Hancock County, in that rural area.
And because nurse practitioners are on the rise across the state and across the nation, so are the number of nurse practitioner MAT providers. However, if your collaborator is not an MAT waivered provider, you can't offer MAT services. So we have a workforce ready and able and well-educated and following the same prescribing guidelines that the CDC issues for all providers, who are ready to go on the MAT issue, who are ready to help in the opioid crisis, but their hands are tied because if their physician doesn't want to do it or doesn't want them to do it, they can't. And we really need all hands on deck.
Well, we will definitely be following that bill as it goes through the proper legislative channels, but that's all the time we have today here on Open Mic. I really appreciate you both being here, and we'll see you guys on Friday.